You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Yes, and as I said earlier, for Dear Science, we are joined once again this week by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. And, I mean, we might as well get straight into this one.
We may as well,
given, yeah, absolutely. Given your reaction as I read it out. We've discussed this story already on a Dear Science show on Tuesday, and we've got an update here.
We have, and, you know, indeed, we often sign off Dear Science by saying that, you know, more research is needed.
Yeah.
And this was one of those instances where indeed more research was needed and indeed has been done.
Yeah. And now we've got an update. It's quite exciting. It's rare that I get to speak on both the start and, I guess, conclusion. Is this a conclusion of the story? A continuation,
it's almost a conclusion, I think. Yeah. So, you know, as Castor said, in April we had a chat about the possible signs of life on the planet K218b.
Mm.
I wonder who came up with that name for it. It does sound very Star Trek, doesn't
it?
Yeah. But this is a planet that's orbiting a star around about 120 light years away from Earth. And just to recap, so workers at Cambridge had been studying this planet. And the way that they can study it is because the planet sometimes gets between its sun and us.
Yes.
And that leads to ridiculously slight dimming of the star's light.
Mm.
And as some of it goes through the planet's atmosphere, that leads to a ridiculously small absorption of some things in the atmosphere, and you can figure out...
We can take a bit of
you
a
can
look.
You can sort of figure out what's in the atmosphere, yeah. Okay? But it's a fraught science. And so these workers at Cambridge had done this experiment. They were using the James Webb Space Telescope, and what they found were potential signatures of a gas called dimethyl sulfide in the atmosphere of K218b. And so they published this in April, and they had collected one set of data, and then they collected another set of data, and they're pretty sure about their data, and you know, they were fairly certain. I think they were saying that the chances of it being noise was something like about 3 in 1,000.
It was quite low.
Yeah. So there have been some other groups who have gone and looked at this. And the reason why we're so interested in this dimethyl sulfide is because on Earth, the only way to make it is through biological processes.
Mm.
And so this hit the news a couple of months ago with basically saying, you know, oh, they've found signs of life on this, you know, on this planet, which was going just a touch far. And so what has happened now is that a couple of other groups have reanalyzed the original data. And basically both of the groups have come to the same conclusion that there's no compelling evidence for the presence of dimethyl sulfide itself.
Oh, even at all. We're ruling it out from the source.
And the data could be reinterpreted in other ways, okay? So what the original authors found, in addition to dimethyl sulfide, they found hydrogen, carbon dioxide, and methane, which are all good sort of molecules if you want life to be happening. So they certainly found those. They get distinct sort of signatures for those from analysing the data. But these other workers now, so there's a bunch of workers in Chicago who have now reanalyzed the data, and they said that there's no statistically significant signal for the presence of dimethyl sulfide in the data. And they reckon it's just noise. It's just random noise, which is a little bit of a, you know, a bit of a slap on the hand.
Yeah, it's a bit of a bummer.
For the original people in Cambridge who did this. And the original folk, you know, they are sort of the world leaders in this stuff. And indeed, one of their former students, who was at Arizona State, he's in another team. And they also looked at the original data. And where the original people had said, okay, so this is dimethyl sulfide, what the team in Arizona did was said, well, this particular spectral signature could be consistent with a whole bunch of other possible molecules.
Wow.
And they said, right, so they looked at the data and said, right, well, there's 59 possible molecules that could be giving that signal in addition to dimethyl sulfide.
Yeah.
And they went through that and they said that no, that they think it's a molecule called propyne.
Propine,
which is related to acetylene. If you've ever heard of acetylene,
No.
You've never heard of acetylene.
Oh, yes, I have.
I've never heard of acetylene.
You've never welded, Kester.
I've never welded. Not once welded.
But so that's a molecule called propine. But the thing, the big thing about propine is that that can be made simply by the action of sunlight. It doesn't require a biological process to make it.
And you'd think by the name, you know, that would be conducive to life, right? Propine. Like trees?
Propine.
Pro-trees. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, jeez. Sorry, I'm up way too early this morning. My goodness me. Yes, good one, Castor. There we go. But so they reckon that, so they're basically saying that the data could be interpreted better in other ways.
Mm.
Okay. And then sort of in response to this, the original authors went back and they looked at 650 possible molecules.
Wow.
And then they've come to the conclusion, or they basically say that, dimethyl sulfide comes out top of the list along with some others.
Right.
First among equals. Yes. So that kind of sort of reduces their argument a little bit.
It's the most optimistic answer, perhaps.
Yeah, basically. And you know, what you're looking at is very, very, very weak. That, you know, this thing's 120 light years away. And, you know, we're analysing the light that comes off it when this tiny little planet gets in the way. You know, they're really pushing the boundaries here. But the good news is that apparently there's been another set of data that have been collected by some other workers.
Oh.
And they are due out probably in a couple of months. And apparently the story is that that's going to really sort of nail this once and for all.
Right.
So
we'll know by then.
We will. So keep listening to Dear Science. You know,
we'll keep you updated on K218b and what's going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we'll see how we go.
Yeah, and this next story about the ninth planet, I mean, when I was a child, we had a ninth planet
Yes, we did.
Is this a great southern continent situation, or could we be dealing with something that's actually there?
That's a really good point, actually, the great southern continent, because it needs balance, doesn't it? The Earth needs to be balanced.
Right.
Yeah, you've got to have land down south, don't you? But, yes, you're right. When I was young, the solar system used to have nine planets, and then some bloody astronomers took a vote in 2006, and on the basis of that vote, they said that Pluto, dear Pluto, that was discovered in 1930, was not a planet, but a dwarf planet.
Oh. Ridiculous.
I mean, same difference, same thing. I guess if K12, it is a planet, I guess Pluto's class as well.
So Pluto was discovered in 1930, and a little bit of history here, because the reason that it was discovered was that people were looking at the orbit of Neptune, which is the next planet in, and it wasn't quite what it should have been, okay? And so they then proposed that there had to be another planet out there that was sort of affecting the orbit,
changing the gravitational
of Neptune,
and
making its orbit not bang on what they would have predicted in the absence of this. And so this is this sort of mysterious planet 9, or after Pluto was discovered, the mysterious planet 10,
right?
Or planet X, indeed.
Planet X. Quite fun.
Okay, and so there is this theory that there is still something out there that we haven't discovered yet, because apparently there are irregularities in this thing called the Kuiper Belt.
Oh, okay? Yes.
Now, we've got an asteroid belt that lies between Mars and Jupiter, which is a whole lot of little bits of rock, basically. And there's this thing called the Kuiper Belt out by Pluto, of which Pluto apparently is a part, and just sort of tiny bits of ice, you know, things and objects and stuff and everything. And sort of the way that they orbit the sun also looks like they're being affected by something else that's being out there.
Something's dragging them
in. And what they reckon is that, you know, if this thing is out there, then it could have a mass about 10 times the mass of Earth. So,
wow.
You know, so it's a decent size.
Yeah, big planet.
Decent size. So people are still looking for this, even though the evidence for it seems to get less and less as the years go on. So there was a bunch of folk over in the States looking for this. And as a result, they have just last week announced the discovery of 2017 OF201.
Oh, just rolls off the tongue.
They have funky names for these things, don't they? And they're saying that this is a dwarf planet. It's about 700 kilometres in diameter, so it's about a third the size of Pluto. The thing that blows my mind is three times further away from Earth than Neptune is. Like, this is just long way away. So whereas Pluto goes around the sun in 248 years,
right,
this thing takes 25,000 years.
Wow. Is it even in the equation then, if it's that far away? I mean, what are we dealing with?
It's a highly eccentric orbit, right, apparently. Very, very, very eccentric. So at the moment it's moving away from the Earth. But, you know, it just blows your mind, the scale of these things. And so they have managed to sort of figure out what its orbit is. And again, this sort of casts further doubt on this whole Planet 9 or Planet X or whatever theory. And so it looks like they might be putting this to bed, that really there's nothing of great size out there that we haven't already seen. And, you know, here we now can basically see to the edge of the observable universe. Mm. And it does seem extraordinary that we would have missed something that's really in our backyard.
Yeah.
You know,
would have been quite obvious.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, they have discovered something of a decent size out there, but it's not this mysterious Planet 9. And, you know, maybe that's just never going to happen. Although, you know, never say never, I guess.
Yeah, any Planet X believers out there may be a little bit distraught after this news. But indeed, Pluto believers, they're still on top.
Yeah,
look,
Pluto's still a damn planet as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, come on. It's got a moon, for goodness sake. That's a, you know, sheesh.
And then this next story, also on space, the Blue Danube played up there, right? Out there, I suppose.
Well, here's a question for you both. Have you seen 2001 A Space Odyssey?
Yes, I have.
I haven't, embarrassingly, but it is on my list of movies to watch. And it is quite high up the list as well.
Well, it should be right at the top. Faith, it's a magnificent
yes,
movie.
Yes, it is. I think it's one of Kubrick's best films.
It's extraordinary. And if you want to see real, real special effects with no CGI or anything like that, it'll just blow your mind how they did this in 1968. Yes. It's just extraordinary. And so this was a movie in 1968 it was released. And there was one very, very famous shot where there's this sort of jump cut from an ape busy beating the crap out of another ape
with
a bunch of bones. Or no, actually throws a bone up in the air, that's right. Throws this bone up in the air, and then there's this jump cut to a shot of the Earth and the spacecraft going around the Earth, and the beautiful Blue Danube waltz, you know the one, starts playing. And so in honour of the 200th anniversary of Johann Strauss's birth, which is this year, so the Blue Danube was played by the Vienna Symphony Orchestra in Vienna the other day. And that's probably not an unusual occurrence, given that it was written there and Strauss was from Vienna and everything. But owing to its use in 2001 A Space Odyssey, they had broadcast this live over the internet, and they'd also broadcast it to a satellite dish in Spain, whose job was then to put it into space, which is really cool. And they're putting it into space apparently in the direction of Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, which are the spacecraft that have now left the solar system. Now, why did they do that? Well, you may or may not know that Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 both have gold-plated records.
Ah, yes, I'm familiar, yeah.
And as part of the... So basically sort of containing things about Earth and everything. And one of the things that they did was they had 27 pieces of music that they put on this to show that, you know, this is all about Earth and everything. So what have we got? We've got Bach, we've got Mozart, we've got Beethoven, we've got Stravinsky, we've got Louis Armstrong, we've got Chuck Berry, and we've got music from Java, Senegal, Australia, New Guinea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Who the heck got to choose those 27 pieces of music?
Narrowing it down must have been a very tough choice.
And there's no Beatles, come on. Which surprised me, I've got to say. But also, there's no Johann Strauss.
No.
And given its association with that amazing shot of space in 2001, Somebody thought that was bad, and so that was a serious omission, so that's what they've done now. So they have beamed this live recording of the beautiful Blue Danube, or by the beautiful Blue Danube, its exact German translation, into space, and now it's got past Voyager, because it took about 23 hours to get to the Voyagers, and now it's past them, and it's heading off goodness knows where.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
That's very exciting, yeah.
So who knows if it will ever be heard.
Yeah, the endless efforts by, I guess, humanity to share a little bit about ourselves with the universe.
Yeah.
It's quite endearing to me, and it speaks a lot to the human spirit. As all of these stories, right, our exploration of space, our endeavours to know a little bit more about this huge cosmic mystery.
Yeah, and the things that we don't know about space, honestly, you know. Mm. It's amazing we know as much as we do, I think, but there's so much more to find out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As always with Dear Science, right? And maybe in space as the most of all, right?
Hey, we could be beaming up into space right now. You know.
That would be incredible. All right. Well, thank you, Alan, for coming in and sharing these space-related stories with us. Thank
Pleasure.
You, as always, Motet. And thank you to Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.